Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, talking bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day. I'm coming live from my den under the stairs here at Dirt Towers in Adlington, Chorley, Lancashire, in the UK. I'm surrounded by my stuff, neatly displayed on my shelves. To my right is my great library of RPGs and my Grognard files. To my left is my ridiculous homemade shrine to the actor Caroline Munro. I'll just give it a tap. Whoa, it spun back round. A white jumpsuit, a murderous helicopter pilot. Yes, it's Naomi from The Spy Who Loved Me. We're back in the shady realms of tradecraft and dirty coats. Yes, this episode is all about mercenaries, spies and private eyes. When we looked at Tunnels and Trolls back in episode 7, we had a revelation. We'd consigned the game to the too silly bin, until we reached back and realised that it was a masterwork of early mechanics which introduced new RPG concepts such as simple resolution, exploding dice, and, dare we say it, fun. We'll be returning to Watson Hall, the home of our Flying Buffalo correspondent, Big Jack Brass, John Hancock. When I say he's a Flying Buffalo correspondent, I don't mean to say that he's a hairy American cow with wings. No, I mean that he covers the games produced by Flying Buffalo Inc., the publishing company who produced Tunnels and Trolls. And in 1983, under the imprint Blade, Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes, a skill-based game set in the world of military espionage and mystery, using the very simple mechanics of TNT in a contemporary real-world setting, written with the sage games master advice from Mike Stackpole, now better known for his contributions to the Star Wars Extended Universe through various best-selling novels that he's written. On the day we recorded this, by some weird synchronicity, Mercenaries, Spies and Private Eyes became available by PDF for the first time on DriveThruRPG. There are still print copies freely available, but it's good to know that it's available at the click of a mouse, a poke of the screen, a tap on your phone, however you prod your receptive device. We've had another review on iTunes. This time it's from Baz from the great gaming podcast What Would the Smart Party Do? If you like two old timers grumbling about the good old days, and who doesn't, then you'll love Baz and Gad's pod, as they've had a wealth of experience. They've just hit 50 episodes, so there's plenty to dive into, and here's what Baz said about ours. I binge listened to the first 12 episodes and I feel like I've had a delicious warm crumpet by the roaring fire with my toasty old box sets and crayon dice. Dirk and Blythe plough through the furrow close to my heart, pen and paper role playing the way that it was and how it is now with the accumulated wisdom of decades. Thanks, Baz. And maybe one day we'll play together. I get the sense from your podcast that we'll get on, as we both like to put game in the game. So, what have we got for you in this file? Well, first, it's Open Box. John provides a potted history of Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes and its supplements and laments on how it became an overlooked RPG. Then it's the second Starburst Memories section. Here we have the overly complicated audience participation feature, and we reflect on our online game of Top Secret before selecting two spy sequences from the world of TV and film. It's extremely complicated. It'll all come clear when you listen to it. Back to Watson Hall, where Big Jack Brass becomes the locum judge, casting a rules lawyer's eye on the finer details of the rules as written. In the final bit, I'll be back to talk about the news about our next Grognard Files fanzine. Until then, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Open box!
I return to Watson Hall, here on the Manchester Riviera, Stalybridge. Bridge. Watson Hall, home to the best Take It As It Comes, Put It Out There, actual play recordings available, and you can get hold of it at ukroleplays.com. Why should you listen? Because Saxons. Watson Hall is also the home to the Grognard Files outsourced archive of Tunnels and Trolls, and home to its venerable curator, Big Jack Brass, John Hancock. Hello there, John.
Hello, welcome back to Perfunctory Manor, the one of the outbuildings of Watson Hall.
Yeah. Okay, last time I was around here, John, we talked about Tunnels and Trolls, and after that there was a massive outpouring from listeners of people rediscovering the game and wanting to go and find it. That must be very good to hear that it's finding new people.
Because they weren't all sock puppets from me. Some of them were real people. I've always sort of thought Tunnels and Trolls is more popular than the Latton, but for some people it's been a kind of... they were a bit embarrassed about it at the time. Like, I used to prefer basic Dungeons & Dragons to advanced Dungeons & Dragons. I just thought it was a more coherent game. But if you actually said that to anyone in 1985 or whatever, you get sneered at. You know, it's, oh, you're playing a kid's game. Well, Tunnels and Trolls, it's got a few funny spell names, so it was a kid's game.
And you've started to make a name for yourself on Twitter as a friend of the friendless in your hashtag OverlookedRPGs.
Friend of the friendless. That's sort of saying I'm a bit desperate for friends myself, isn't it? I did Great Game Art, Overlooked RPGs and RPG adverts, mainly because every time over the years I've tried a hashtag game on Twitter, it's had precisely two responses and then died a death. So I thought, I'll just put stuff out on my own under a hashtag. And I noticed there were an awful lot of really good bits of art that weren't getting noticed. There were some terrific adverts and just some that brought the memories back. And there were whole games that people had kind of forgotten about, and they're great playable games. But either the company's out of business, or the thing's out of print, or you know, not in PDF. And why shouldn't you play it now? Why shouldn't you have a go? They're not all brilliant, by the way. I mean, some of them, I think they're overlooked, and they've kind of had their day. They're very old-fashioned.
Yeah.
But just because something came out years ago, this of course, is going to be complete news to you. The idea that something that came out years ago is still quite good.
Well, that's interesting, that, because I interpreted the overlooked RPGs as meaning that they were overlooked at the time of release.
Yes, many of them were, yeah. But it's because of that, they've got no real legacy presence on the internet. You'll often find people referring to games that are out of print and so on, and saying, oh, this was great, where can I get this edition of a game and so on. But they tended to be bigger games that everybody remembers. Whereas there's things like a lot of the Fantasy Games Unlimited ones, Privateers and Gentlemen, which is the sort of Age of Sail, Napoleonic, Nelson's Navy, that sort of thing. I mean, it was never going to be a huge game because it's a fairly niche historical setting. And of course, historical games don't do so well. But it's a terrific game. It's written by Walter John Williams, who's written cyberpunk books and historical naval fiction. All this backup for it, all this background, lovely game. Completely forgotten, of course. But it's actually still available, incredibly. It's still in print. People don't even realise Fantasy Games Unlimited is still in business. But they chug along.
So what causes a game to become overlooked, then?
Some of it's bad timing. And actually, I think Mercenary Spies and Private Armies is a fine example of that, which we'll certainly get onto. You're dealing with small companies. I mean, everybody apart from TSR was a small company in the 80s, really. And even though there was a big boom, it didn't last very long. There was actually a huge slump in the mid-80s, and an awful lot of businesses disappeared. You got all the magazines that were around then, but most of those actually disappeared as well. Mm-hmm. Or what happened with a few is they went on to different publishers who tried to sort of take the bat on a run and then discovered why it was that the previous publisher was stopping doing it. And, you know, they went on for years, but nobody remembers that either. And I discovered in the last couple of weeks that Sorcerer's Apprentice, the Flying Buffalo magazine supporting Tunnels and Trolls, had actually continued after Flying Buffalo had stopped printing. I'd never heard of this before. But what it effectively became was kind of a fanzine produced by someone else who sort of bought the name. It's just not the same thing. So it's not got the distribution, it's not got the sort of advertising and the penetration. Most of the games that we were exposed to in the 80s, in the UK, if it wasn't in White Dwarf, you had to be lucky enough to have a local shop that might stock something. And if it wasn't in your local shop, how would you know about it?
Yeah.
Maybe you'd got a friend who'd been down to London to the Virgin Megastore and seen something new. But it was the magazine, they were the only way you were actually getting this thing. And different companies, they couldn't advertise in everything, they advertised in different magazines. Shops carried different lines. You might find one shop carried Tri-Tac games. I saw them in a Games Workshop once, it was amazing. But you wouldn't, you know, go to a different shop, they wouldn't have it. So if you didn't live near to somewhere that had that game, you haven't heard of it. And how can you possibly make any kind of judgment on whether to buy it if you don't know it's there?
Yeah. Well, that's your hashtag on Twitter. And it caught my eye that Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes featured on that hashtag of yes. Overlooked RPGs. Yeah. And it surprised me because I seem to remember this being a big release at the time.
Kind of.
And I think it's because of our personal circumstances, because our club had a prime directive that, you know, if you were a GM, you owned that game and you weren't. So our club played Top Secret, and so I was looking for a game that I could play espionage with, because it's one of my favourite genres in movies, and I really wanted someone to do it. And when I saw that cover advertised, I just had to have it.
Yeah, it is quite a cover. Mike Stackpole, who wrote the game, apparently wanted to get Frank Hamilton, who was one of the big cover artists for the pulps in the 30s, wanted to get something from him. But I think he may have still been alive at the time, but he ended up getting this cover painted by Frank Hamilton's son, Brian Hamilton, which is terrific. And he also did one which is fairly famous, that shows up on Justice Inc. And I think there's a more modern pulp game that bought the rights to use that illustration as well. And they just are absolutely pulpy espionage. You know, I mean, you've got your Bogart character, you've got your karate-kicking spy, quite clearly a French resistance fighter, you can tell by the beret and the tash, and the femme fatale in a, you know, in a white fur coat. It's got all the elements, and the big brooding guy in the background who could be the villain or he could be the man in charge of the organisation. Big map, big explosions, and you just think, yeah, that's actually a really good cover. And let's not forget, it was, what, 1983? There were a lot of very bad covers around as well at the time, even on some quite big games. So that did attract me. Although, weirdly enough, the thing that I remember the most when I first saw it was this back cover. And it's this illustration at the top here, which you haven't got on your copy. Michael Kaczowski did the interior illustrations from this. It's a really stark black, white, and then lettered tint grey. And it's the guy in the tuxedo. There's almost no definition to the character. Any dark element is absolutely flat black, and he's just cracking a safe. He's just listening to the tumblers. And that's all that is. It's tacked on as if it's a photograph that's been attached to a file. But immediately that told me this was the kind of the moment in the movie where Bond or one of the Mission Impossible team has snuck away from the party. They've managed to get into the room, and they're just doing that, and somebody is going to come up to the door in a second. It was just all there. And this game had a cover that sort of said, it can do all of this, which was really appealing.
Yes.
It also wasn't massively focused, which I think may have partly been why people didn't buy it.
Yeah. I have some vague memories of playing a game. One game in particular, I remember, was at the height of the miners' strike in the UK. And the player characters were a group of mercenaries employed by the National Union of Mine Workers to stop the import of coal to try and break the deadlock in the strike.
I don't think we were that political at that point. That is quite... quite bold.
Yeah.
And my dad was a miner, so...
Well, and I remember playing it, but I just remember at the time people were frustrated by the system. And I can't remember why it was, but I think it was that the element of failure was quite easy to fail to do things.
It's lethal. You know, if you're expecting it to be the sort of you are the hero, you can take several bullets and keep struggling on. If you're expecting that, it's going to disappoint you. But there are easy ways around it. It is hard. I suppose it is quite easy to fail with the saving roll system because they've got a skill system attached to it. Otherwise, it's fundamentally Tunnels and Trolls.
Yes.
Without the silly spell names, with a few tweaks to make it a bit more realistic, and then with a formalised skill system, rather than the sort of patched on things we used to do with TNT. So, like, you grew up in a fishing village. Yeah, of course you know how to use a boat.
Yeah.
That was roughly what we used to do.
Yeah, well, perhaps we'll look at the rules in a bit more detail later. But yeah, I remember pitching it to the group as TNT with TNT. That was my line there. So I could have had that one.
I can't believe they didn't go for that.
But did you play it? Did you play it back in the day?
A bit. Unfortunately, it was one of those games that I played the solos, of which there were, I think, a full two. And I used bits of this with Tunnels and Trolls quite a lot. And I keep coming back to it and thinking, I really ought to just do more with this. I've got something bubbling away in a pot which has got far too many things bubbling in it at the moment. There's a very good blog, actually. If you look up Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes and look for I Waste the Buddha with My Crossbow. It's a blog from a few years ago, and there's this particular post he did about Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes, which kind of hits the mark for me. He had the game, he saw the game, he was going to get rid of it, he never did much with it, and then suddenly he sort of saw how good it is. And it's a bit of that Tunnels and Trolls thing. It's actually a really capable game, but it isn't necessarily that obvious.
Yes.
And I think with a lot of games, with a lot of overlooked RPGs, it's probably the same thing. In some cases, you have to actually either put a bit of work in or just get that moment of revelation. And in some ways, it's easier just to pick up a different game. And I think that's why things get overlooked as well.
Yeah. So you mentioned that it had solo games available. What other supplements came out? Was it well supported?
No. Well, there's actually a bit of... I'll just go to the sort of history of it in some respects, because we've got a few things here about the announcements. 1982, it gets mentioned that it's coming out. But this is actually from the last issue of Space Gamer that Steve Jackson Games published. That was another magazine that went on to a different publisher, and you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who bought it afterwards. Their news page, Scanner, it's got news about the hurricane hitting Lou Zocchi's warehouse and all the stuff he lost there, and it's got play-by-mail news. But the big story is this. FBI selling much of the Blade line. Now, Blade was a subdivision of Flying Buffalo, and it was going to be their role-playing thing. Because Flying Buffalo, don't forget, are a play-by-mail company. They still are. They basically invented the commercial play-by-mail business. So Blade was going to be Liz Danforth and Mike Stackpole and all them doing role-playing stuff. And they hadn't actually been Blade for very long before essentially the role-playing hobby tanked. So they stopped doing Sorcerer's Apprentice. It went through that kind of slow death that many things did of, you know, 18 months between issues and an apology and a double-sized issue and all that. And they were trying to sell off a lot of their properties. And I don't think they actually did exactly. They did some work with Task Force Games. They did some co-produced things. And the edition of Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes that you've got there with the black and white cover, which is a bit of a shame that you take one of its big selling points and you take it away. You'll notice on the back that that's Sleuth Publications from San Francisco.
Ah, yes, yeah.
And it's got some very minor differences inside, one of which is hilarious, but again, I'll get to that later. Essentially, they needed to reprint, and in fact, another supplement, a Flying Buffalo one called Mugshots Taking Care of Business. This actually has an introduction by Rick Loomis where he talks all about this. What's happened, how this game, this supplement almost never came out and all that. And he talks about how, essentially, Sleuth Publications didn't really do anything with the game. They did a reprint, which he wasn't particularly thrilled about. It was kind of a cut-and-paste job with the additions. Nice box. I've got the box there. It's all right. And then it just languished. They didn't really promote it and so on. And as he said, I could have done that. You know, without wishing to be harsh, Rick Loomis has let a number of games languish. Not, I'm sure, out of any actual failure on his own part, as the fact that he's a small publisher in a hard world. Yeah. And play-by-mail pays the bills. So you've got this game where it was starting to get a few supplements out, and then essentially the rug was pulled out from under the company. So what you end up with is a different company takes over the rules. Flying Buffalo got it back, but the different company takes over the actual core game and does very little in the way of promoting it. You then get things like this, the Armory.
I've never seen that before.
You've never seen that. That's by Kevin Dockery, a name you may also spot on the rather similar Edge of the Sword Volume 1, which was never followed by another volume, Compendium of Modern Firearms. This was from Artel Saurian Games. And there were quite a lot of these things out in the 80s, so this is a rather far-ranging answer. It's just a big book of guns. Kevin Dockery is one of the designers of the Morrow Project, which was another big book of guns. So they were supplements that were not specifically for Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes, but they were including stats for quite a number of games, including Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes. This one's the same, but the actual Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes content is like a paragraph. It's how to adapt it.
This really is just a catalogue of
ways to kill people. Yeah,
yeah, ways to get bombs, everything.
I mean, it's quite cool in that you've got things like the Wellrod pistol from the Second World War, the completely silent, very weird thing that looks like a bit of plumbing that you're pointing at someone. So you can get some scenario ideas from it, but really, I mean, a gun's a gun in a game, you know. I'm not a rules nut for those. So you've got stuff like that. You've got Grenadier models, not necessarily known for role-playing stuff these days, if anyone remembers Grenadier at all. They did a mercenary adventure, Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes, raid on Rajalapur. So there's that one. Hero Games did a cross-statted adventure for Espionage, which I think was later known as Danger International. I think it was that way around. So that's an adventure for both those games. So effectively, it looks like an ordinary Hero Games product. It's also got the Mercenary Spies Private Eyes stuff on it. Unfortunately, they didn't do Lands of Mystery, which is a rather brilliant Lost Worlds supplement. They didn't cross-stat that, which was a big shame.
So the Espionage, did that come out around the same time?
Around the same time. And it gets mentioned in Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes because all these people kind of work together. This is Justice Inc. from Hero Games. And you'll notice that the names on the front include Mike Stackpole. So they were working together. They were coming up with these agreements for cross-statting things. And it could have been terrific, but I really do think that all these companies suffered from the timing, unfortunately. There are almost no magazine articles about Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes. Sorcerer's Apprentice was unfortunately winding down to its last couple of issues by the time the game came out, so there's not much in there at all. There's one in Different Worlds here by Dave Arneson of D&D fame, but all this actually is, there's no sort of preamble, there's no real article as such. It's how to adapt the solo adventure for Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes to be a Games Master thing. So all they've done is put down some extra stats, draw up a few maps to make it easy, and then get on with it yourself. So again, that's kind of a disappointment.
So that's the Adventure of the Jade Jaguar, isn't it?
Which, where have I put that? It's here. So, no, it's right in front of me, in fact. This was the first and for many years the only solo for it, and it's the sort of thing, it's exactly what it looks like from the cover. You're talking sort of Aztecs and Indiana Jones type stuff,
and it is like a demo as well, isn't it? So it
tests, in many ways
it tests some of the main features of the game, doesn't it? I seem to remember like many TNT solos, it could be quite short, you could be in and out in quite
I mean, that's without getting killed, obviously. Anything Flying Buffalo put out, pretty much, the chances of you getting killed was rather high. But I don't mean that. I mean a successful path to a varying degree of success. You could replay the game a few times, but even so, you never really felt that you were able to get into the adventure before it was over. So, a bit of a shame. And then, a few years later, we get these, and you're on to the 90s, basically. It's Perfect Bound covers. These are from Flying Buffalo. Totally different look. Mugshots and Mugshots 2. The first one, written by Dave Arneson, co-designer of Dungeons & Dragons, Case of the Pacific Clipper. This is a much more extensive 1930s solo. And as he did with the previous adventure, he's also written it up how to run it as a Games Master adventure. So that's quite nice. And certainly, if you want to actually try Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes and run a solo, I mean, try J. Jaguar. It's available as a PDF. You'll have much more fun in itself actually playing Pacific Clipper because it's just a much more involved game. And it's got Nazis. So, And then the second one was essentially loads of maps, play aids and non-player characters. And that's really all that is. So a little superfluous for my particular needs, but obviously I wasn't going to not buy it. I mean, the solitaire adventure in here, I think, is something like 6 pages long. You know, it's really short.
So just to clarify the availability at the moment, so Mercenaries, Spies and Private Eyes is still in print, is it?
Yeah, technically. Flying Buffalo are not out of business, despite the fact that every time you mention the company to someone who used a game, they go, oh, are they still around? I thought they went out of business years ago. Yeah, they're still around. I think the game's something like $9.95. But you can certainly go to Noble Knight or direct to flyingbuffalo.com and you can order a copy of this game.
And some of the supplements, they're harder to get hold of, I imagine.
They are. I think J. Jaguar might actually be out of print technically, but it's in PDF. That's probably why they've put it in PDF, because it's no longer in stock. Things like Radar Rajal Poor and the Armory and all these, I mean, they're basically easy eBay purchases. Put a search to just keep going, and they'll come up. But they're not that expensive, really. You'll occasionally see people trying to sell them for a stupid amount of money, but don't be fooled into thinking they're weird collector's items, because they're just not. I think it's the same thing that Tunnels and Trolls has got. It's the saving roll mechanic. And although when those games came out, you know, sort of 79, 83, I don't think enough was made about this, the saving roll mechanic, how it can be this kind of universal, oh yeah, sure, give it a try. Make a second level saving roll. It's a really easy system. And it lets you just do something without having to look up the rule.
Well, we'll have a look at the rules in a bit more detail, but before we do that, whatever happened to Mike Stackpole? Whatever became of him?
Mike Stackpole? Oh, I don't know. I mean, he's barely heard of now, what with his New York Times best-selling novels and everything. yes, he always, I think, wanted to be a writer. And In fact, my games master for Chivalry and Sorcery and Call of Cthulhu back when I was a teenager, he'd written to Flying Buffalo about his character. And he got a letter back from Mike Stackpole, which was a short story about his character.
Right, amazing. Yeah,
and he lost it. He was really, really annoyed that he lost it. So I think Stackpole was always very much into the story and how things fitted, which comes through in the notes, the Games Master notes, in Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes. It's not just a set of rules. The thing that you really remember are the sort of articles in it. And these days, of course, he's an author. He did some work in computer games, as many people did. Wasteland, if you remember the original Wasteland game, I think there's a sequel around. That's actually Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes is the rule system underneath it. And the people who wrote it, Les Danforth, Mike Stackpole, Ken Sinandre, as well as the company that put it out, you know, they were essentially taking this and make it a post-apocalyptic setting. Yeah. But it does sort of effectively run Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes in the background.
Yeah.
And I have seen the fan supplement that lets you play that setting with these rules as a role-playing game. So,
right.
He's done a few bits and pieces, you know. Yeah, the lad's done well.
He's done well. Okay, thanks, John. And until we come back to look at the rules, goodbye.
Yeah.
Starburst memories. This is part of the podcast where we look at film, television and literature that have informed our gaming. As part of our spy sequence, which we started with Top Secret, we've devised an elaborate, overcomplicated audience participation. So we're in the room of role-playing rambling. I'm here with Blythe. Hello, Blythe.
Hello, Doug.
I've turned it into a screening room because we're going to look at the thing. Don't look like that. I don't mean that kind of screening room. It's nothing too invasive.
I'm so worried what you meant. A man of my age.
I mean...
you know it, you know.
I mean, we're going to look at particular spy sequences.
Yes.
Now, the idea of this is that we're going to put this out to the vote. So, so far, we've got a fight scene out of Casino Royale.
Yes.
We've got the scene out of 3 Days of Condor.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to introduce two new sequences to talk about. I'm going to add those in, and there's going to be a poll on them. And then people, we will recreate
yes.
the scene with a system of the listener's yeah. choice.
People are going to pick the most difficult one to recreate, aren't they?
It's an overcomplicated audience participation
yes.
experience. But before we get into that, we've had some post. So let me just
okay.
have a look at it. Because let's look at Top Secret. Okay, here we go. This is from DM Mike from Save for Half podcast. Do you remember DM Mike? He never agrees with you.
He never agrees with me now.
Okay. So he's...
not you, is it, under a pseudonym? He's another person, isn't he?
He is.
You being difficult.
He sent this. Okay. Hey, Grog's under the stairs. DM Mike here from the new Save for Half podcast. While listening to Judge Blythe discuss the problems with Top Secret, Dirk said that the tables were a seedbed for ideas that allowed the GM to build ideas and adventures. The judge said, and that's you,
mm-hmm.
okay,
yeah.
that Dirk was basing this on 30 years of experience and a new gamer, picking up Top Secret in 1980, would follow the rules as written. That was the basis of the argument, the dispute?
Well, yes, I think it was.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like I'm under oath here.
Yeah, you are under oath. Okay. Ah! I shuddered with fevered intensity. That's what it says here.
I don't think I've ever had that effect on anyone.
Yeah.
I'd be appalled or pleased.
You've made someone in Texas shudder.
I've made someone all miles away shudder.
Another thing I can tell Judge Blythe was wrong about.
Oh, another thing.
But my wife,
oh, yeah.
DM Liz, heard me exclaim and explained to my horror that she said that Judge Blythe was correct. We're dividing families here. It's very divisive.
Well, she's a very wise woman, isn't she?
So Liz's argument was that the fact that she was a new gamer in 1980 and when she saw the tables, she was confused. Whereas when we saw the tables, they ignited our imaginations and didn't see them as a straitjacket. We used them in the same way as the monster reaction table in the Holmes Basic D&D. So, DM Liz and DM Mike came to the conclusion that although we came to Top Secret early in 1980, I was part of a gaming club and the veterans of the club were 25 to 35 years old, taught me, the 12-year-old, how to play. But Liz had to introduce a group of friends to RPG and she didn't find a group until she was in high school. Thus, sigh.
I'm right.
I must say, Judge Blythe is right.
Well, thank you, DM Mike. I appreciate that. I think it's a very big of him, isn't it, to disagree and then concede that I was right.
Yeah.
But I think that is the point, isn't it, that people who... perhaps from a wargaming background or had more experience with games, wouldn't be as daunted. But if you were coming at these things fresh, as we were, you know, we didn't have a game. We enjoyed RPGs. We didn't have a gaming background, did we?
No.
I mean, we've said before, we weren't really into games until we discovered RPGs. So
since then, we've actually played Top Secret. So we've experienced it at home. We've had a game with patrons.
Yes,
we did Operation Fast Pass on Roll20 with a group of guys from the Patreon Club. And so what do you think? So rules as written or rules as played? How's that experience been?
We didn't use that many rules, did we? I mean, it was pretty. Although when you look at the rule book, it's full of tables. When we actually played it, it felt, if I'd never seen the rule book, it felt very rules light.
Yeah.
Strangely. So yeah. If you were oblivious to what was in the rules, you'd think, well, this is a relatively straightforward game.
See, I think what I found from games mastering it is that, to some extent, I think you're right that so far we haven't really touched on the mechanics such as they are, because having games mastered and having to understand the rules in a bit more detail, I realise that there's a lack of mechanics. There's it doesn't really explain what to do, other than the character creation. Top secret doesn't really give you
what to do with the rules.
So I think it's a basic percentage score, and then a table to find out the effects of what's happened. So this scenario that we had is Operation Fast Pass, and we kind of played it as a Man from Uncle, Ocean's 11 type adventure in the Cold War Budapest, where you had to find a defector and extract him from a puzzle convention and tape him across the Iron Curtain. But I think what Top Secret did is it gave you enough to give you the flavour of those kind of games, those kind of experiences.
Yes. Well, I think... But what I thought was interesting about playing Top Secret now, and I don't think this would have been necessarily true back in the day, because back in the day it would have been the early 80s and the Cold War would have been on, so it would have felt like a contemporary game. Because it was felt like a period piece, you could almost ham it up a bit.
Couldn't you? Because we certainly did.
And I think you as Games Master did, because there was that sense of, oh, the KGB are here, and there's this here, and there's that there. And it all felt like a pastiche, in a sense.
Yeah.
But the original game wasn't. The original game was set in the current present day. So that was an odd element to it, that actually it felt more engaging, because it felt like you were playing in a fictional world of sorts, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Even though it was as if it was a make-believe world almost of the past.
And to give Top Secret credit here, I think what the rules did is furnish you with the things as characters to do secret agency type things.
Yes.
So you had a group of characters who all performed functions within a team.
Yes.
And it got you thinking like spies. As a team of spies.
Well, in that sense, that's where it mirrored D&D, doesn't it? I mean, although it was made by TSR, and the system isn't like D&D at all, you know.
Yeah.
But in that sense, it did, because it had types, didn't it? Had backgrounds that almost felt like character classes.
Yeah.
You know, so I was the assassin, and it felt very much like, well, my job's to kill people, that's what I do best.
Yeah.
Whereas someone else was a kind of surveillance expert, and their job was to, you know, keep an eye, keep tabs on people and bug rooms. So it did feel like character classes in a way.
Yeah.
You know, the game system's nothing like D&D, but that bit was similar.
And I think what it did was, in this episode, we're looking at Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes. And that's a much more generic resolution. Yeah. So when you come up against something, it's just a simple saving resolution in most cases. However, it's quite broad and generic in a way that Top Secret isn't. The mechanics of Top Secret make you behave in a particular way.
They channel you into a particular set of behaviours, because it's...
So even the turn sequence of where you know, you can have surprise, you match your level of surprise against your opponent's level of surprise, and then look on a table to see who has the advantage. But even that way encourages you to sneak around. The turn sequence means that hand-to-hand combat comes first, so you've got a chance to disarm an opponent beforehand. Yeah. Yeah. So these like little...
Which may not be necessarily realistic, but... It's the kind of things that happen in films.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing that happen in spy films.
Whereas in Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes, which John acknowledges, that's not what it does. I mean, the combat is fairly lethal in Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes. And it is quite generic. And when you're faced with that rule book, although it gives you hints and tips on how to create scenarios in the particular genres it covers, the flavour depends on you having the skills, rather than anything mechanically that's built in.
Well, I think I remember buying or having. I'm not sure who bought it first.
I bought it first.
Did you buy it first? It's one of those games that passed around. I think one of the reasons it was passed around was because it felt rather daunting for those reasons. So Top Secret had a sense of, all right, it's James Bondy, it's East versus West. As you say, it pushed you in a particular way in terms of genre and the way you felt that it was supposed to be played.
Yeah.
Whereas Merchant of Spies and Private Eyes was open-ended. In some ways, generic role-playing games. I mean, I've looked at Fate, and I think Fate's a really good game. It's a good game. We've played it, and I think it's good. But because it's generic, there's that sense of, well, where do I hang, what peg do I hang everything on?
Yeah.
Because it's not going to be set in the real world, it's going to be set in a fictional genre world, isn't it, of one description or another. Where do I position it? How do I frame it for players? And that's what a lot of role-playing is about, isn't it? The world you're playing in is framed in a particular way. So how do you frame it when it's just do whatever you want with it?
Well, I think what we're finding is that a peculiar thing's happening while we're looking at these spy RPGs, in that it's like 12 Angry Men, isn't it? I'm becoming a little bit obsessed with mechanical things and rules, whereas you're becoming more loosey-goosey with the rules.
I am. I'm more and more into the, just a nice fluid system that allows you to do things you want, and the resolution's quite simple. Yeah. Yes.
What am I becoming here?
What am I becoming?
Anyway, the main reason we're here in this screening room is to look at films. Mm. So, well, you've got your table. You've got a D10 there.
I have.
Okay. I'm going to roll first. Okay. I've got the initiative, whether you like it or not. Okay, here goes. Oh. Ah, it's a good one, this one. It's Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. And this is the Thomas Alfredson version, the film that came in 2011. I suppose Thomas Alfredson, he did Let the Right One In, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
Spies and Vampires. Who'd have thought that would work? Yeah, anyway. So the sequence I'm going to look at, and this is a film. This is the film that the first words that John Hurt says is, trust no one, Jim.
Yeah.
Trust no one, Jim. And that kind of sets up the idea of this, because this is the idea of... you know, the British intelligence service, there's a mole operating at the highest level, and John Hurt, as control, wants to seek it out and find out who it is. And the sequence I'm particularly interested in is when Jim, Mark Strong, is sent to Budapest, and this is early on, so there's no spoilers here, this happens in the opening sequence almost. He goes to Budapest and he's in an arcade, meeting a general, an ongoing general, who's going to reveal who the mole is at the very heart of British intelligence. You know the sequence?
I do, yeah.
It's and the reason I pick it is the way that it's constructed is very, very clever, because obviously the seeds of doubt are being sown by this film, visually as well as in the dialogue, because they enter the arcade, there's somebody sweeping up as they're talking. There's a woman breastfeeding. A woman opens the shutters, and all the time you're aware and conscious that
something's going to happen.
Something's
setting up that thing of don't trust these people. Trust no one. Don't trust the man who's road sweeping. Don't trust the woman who's breastfeeding, etc. Yeah.
And when the waiter sweating profusely.
Yeah.
And so this general, before he's going to reveal who the mole is, the shots ring out, and then he does it. But I mean, this is very much a story about relationships and English etiquette and not revealing your true feelings as much as it is about spies. But I think it's interesting from a gaming point of view to think how you set that up. Can you do it? Can you do something like this where you can't trust anybody? There's a rat in the house. And nobody knows who it is.
So you mean even with the players?
With the players, yeah. One of the players could be.
That's the interesting question, isn't it? Whether the other player who betrays the other players. It's always a bit awkward, that, isn't it?
Yeah. But have we ever done that? I don't think we have we? Is it desirable to have some a setup like that?
Yeah, I've got mixed feelings about it because my general view is that role-playing games work when players cooperate. So it's an enjoyable experience when the games master puts you in a tight spot and you cooperate to get out of that tight spot, you know, and work as a team. That can be good fun. The idea that one of the players is going to betray the rest of you, I don't know. I could see it working maybe as a one shot, you know.
But I even think if you have over a sustained period a set of NPCs that you don't trust,
that's okay.
I think it becomes wearisome as a player.
Yeah,
it becomes. I think it's because of that strange relationship that players have with games masters.
I can see what you mean. It can become a bit tedious if you feel you can't trust anybody. I mean, Call of Cthulhu suffers from this sometimes, doesn't it? Where you think, oh, everybody's a cultist, everyone's got a hidden agenda. And then there's a point where you think, but would you feel like that if you were living in that world? You know, would you not trust the barmaid? Would you not trust the waiter? Would you not trust the bellboy in the hotel? I mean, you think, oh, come on. You know, even real spies can't behave like that. They'd go crazy, wouldn't they? I mean, there must be a sense in which you trust, you know, some people. You buy a newspaper at the newsagents and you have a bit of interaction with the NPC newspaper seller. Yeah. And they go, oh, wow, I won't trust him. Yeah. But you wouldn't really behave like that, would you?
No.
In real life. So I know what you mean. It can become a bit tedious. But I think that's a trick for the games master to pull, isn't it? What the games master needs to do is emphasise certain NPCs who may or may not be trustworthy.
Yeah.
And maybe de-emphasise, if that's the word, NPCs who are not particularly relevant, so that the players don't get into a paranoid state where... Because I've seen that happen, actually, and I think we've played games like that, where you get to a point where you don't trust anybody, and then you get to a point where you don't care.
Yes.
You get to a point where you think, the games master's kind of taking the mickey a bit here, because I don't trust anyone, so I won't trust anyone, but you know what, I don't really care.
See, I love the elements within Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy for gaming, because I do think it is very intriguing, isn't it, to have that kind of setup, to know that there's somebody betraying you deep within you. It could be anybody, and they've got their own motivations. But I think it's right. It's getting that balance right so that it matters, and to give people enough clues of what it could be. And I think that's what this film does, isn't it? This film is beautifully composed, and it's its composition that allows that doubt to happen. And it's also giving you clues in the way that people glance at each other. And that'd be great to kind of replicate in a game, but I think that would have to be done mechanically.
Well, possibly, but you're right. It's a good example that whilst trust no one is the kind of motto of the film, it does focus on certain key characters. So as a viewer, in the same way that maybe as a player, if it was an RPG scenario, it does focus on certain people. So you can dismiss some people. You immediately, as a viewer, start to dismiss some people, don't you? And you narrow it down to about four or five characters where you think, right, well, the mole is one of these people. And that, I suppose, how it would work in a role-playing game. What you need is a bunch of NPCs who are prominent enough to make you think, right, these are the people we don't trust. Because if we don't trust anyone, it falls apart a little bit, I think. Yeah. Well, there's a danger it can fall apart as a game.
Yeah. Knight's Black Agent has a mode of play, so it has different modes of play. So, for example, it has the burned agent, you know, the dust mode, which means that things really hurt. So when you get hit, it hurts. And they also have this idea of a mirror thing, and that's where trust comes into it. Yeah. So, and it deals with that mechanically through your kind of relationship trees with NPCs and player characters.
I think it is desirable to have that lack of trust in NPCs, and it is exciting to feel you can't trust people and try and work out who you can and can't trust. Yeah. That can be an interesting game.
To a point,
but I'm less convinced by the idea that a player would be a sort of a mole or somebody who betrays the other characters. That's not so sure about that. Yeah. Particularly if it was a campaign where you might get attached to your character and then find out that they're dead because of another player. So I'm not quite convinced about that.
How would a player deal with the situation that Mark Strong found himself in?
All guns blazing, probably.
So the breastfeeding woman would have got
shoot everyone, you know. Well, that's not. Well, that's one of the problems with role playing games, isn't it? That there's that in the role playing game when a player feels threatened, they just start bullets flying everywhere. Don't really care because they're NPCs. You know, it's not a woman breastfeeding; it's an NPC shooter.
Okay. Well, let's choose your sequence at random.
Okay, at random. Okay. Roll the dice.
All right, guys.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, my sequence is not so much a sequence; it's an episode. I think qualifies. It's an episode of Spooks.
I'm not sure it does.
Well, it'd be a short conversation if it doesn't. You want me to do this podcast? It's an episode of Spooks, episode 5, I think, series 3, called Love and Death.
Right. We should explain what Spooks is, shouldn't we?
Spooks was a TV series in the UK.
Yeah, I think it's known as MI5 in America and Canada.
Is it? Oh, right, okay. Yeah. So, which was kind of like a traditional TV series in the noughties. Well, I think it ran from about 2003 to about 2011, 12.
Yeah.
Ran for quite a while, didn't it?
Yeah.
And it was basically like MI5, wasn't it?
MI5, Section D, anti-terrorism.
Yeah, that kind of thing, you know.
I think this was like a very, very British response to 24.
Yes, it was a bit, yeah.
So war on terror.
Yeah. War on terror, fanatical kind of extremist groups of all descriptions.
Yeah, some of them quite ridiculous.
Some of it was quite ridiculous, but I have a particular affection for this episode. Because
so what happens in this
episode? What happens in this episode is that two of the central characters, Danny and Zoe, are sent to intercept a biological scientist, expert in chemistry, biological weapons, scientist, British scientist, who is believed to be heading to Europe to sell his secrets to the highest bidder and sell it to, you know, fanatical groups, some of which may be ridiculous, but nonetheless fanatical groups.
Yeah.
So for, you know, biological terrorism, biological warfare. And initially, I think the idea is that they're supposed to dissuade him or capture him. But then they find out that he's already done the deal and they're told to kill him. He's a diabetic and they're told to inject him with insulin in his sleep and it'll just look like an accident or natural causes. But what the episode centres on is their guilt, particularly Danny's guilt, because Danny, at the beginning, Danny says he's never killed anyone. And then Zoe suffers from chronic seasickness, so it falls to him to do the deed. And the whole episode, in some ways it's kind of an odd episode, because a lot of Spooks is ridiculous stuff, running around, car chases, people being shot with guns, all this kind of stuff. But this is a more sedate episode where they're stuck on a ferry and they talk to this guy, they get to know him a bit, but of course they've got to kill him. Mm. And the reason I picked it is I think it raises a very interesting question about role-playing games. In that if this was a role-playing scenario, the players would have no qualms whatsoever about killing this guy because he's an NPC. But what fuels this drama, and I think it fuels other espionage dramas, I thought of, like, for example, Callum with Edward Woodward, which was a series back in the late 60s, early 70s, I think.
Yeah.
He was a kind of government assassin. He was racked with guilt. And in this episode of Spooks, Danny is racked with guilt and has to be persuaded to do it for the greater good. But he doesn't like the idea. He has to kill someone in cold blood while they're sleeping. You know, it's a kind of murder of someone who, whilst he might be selling his secrets and the consequences of that could be terrible, he still has to kill someone in the sleep in a rather cowardly, murderous way.
Yeah.
And it raises that question, doesn't it? How do you bring those issues into a role-playing game?
Yeah.
Of guilt and kind of those issues, because it's very difficult, isn't it? In the, and particularly in spy dramas or modern day dramas. So, you know, if you're playing, I don't know, Call of Cthulhu, or you're playing, I don't know, Traveller or something like that, it's less of an issue, isn't it? But if you're playing a modern day role playing game like Top Secret or Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes, it raises that issue, doesn't it? Of, well, it's set in the here and now, it's set in the modern world, it's set maybe in the present day, in the moment. And killing people generally is bad. It's okay to hack through a lot of orcs in a dungeon, because it's not real, is it? Mm. And orcs are chaotic evil. And in the weird moral world of role playing, it doesn't matter. If you're a paladin, you're a lawful good paladin, you take your broadsword out and hack your way through a lot of orcs. It's fine, it's all right, no one's worried about that. But in Top Secret, are you supposed to kill somebody? But it's difficult, it's very, very difficult to bring that into a role playing game, isn't it?
Yeah. I think there's another dimension to it as well, in that setup, because it takes place now and in the post War on Terror. Mm. There's doubt over intelligence, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah.
So it does become a moral choice.
Yes.
So yeah. Where, you know, previously you might say, right, it's an instruction, I've been ordered to kill somebody. But you might, you can't reliably say
yes.
that this individual is going to go on to sell it. Because what if it's wrong? What if the information's wrong?
But in a role-playing game, that's difficult to replicate, isn't it? Because players could just go, well, who cares? Tell you what, we're just obeying orders, never mind.
Yeah.
But sometimes maybe what you want to create in a modern-day setting is that notion of you're doing something terrible. You're doing something terrible, and as a human being, there will be consequences on your conscience. But in a role-playing game, I don't know. We need a game with conscience points, don't we?
Yeah. But I do think there are games that try to deal with that in terms of, you know, your reputation points and that kind.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. I think it's really difficult to do that in a satisfying way.
Yeah.
And again, I come back to that question: is it desirable? Is the fun?
You're taking the fun out of it. Yes.
Unless you've got a particularly interesting, dramatic setup, is there any fun in that?
Well, it depends whether you think these games are about fun, doesn't it? I mean, I've certainly sat through some that I think they have been about fun.
But it's...
I know what you mean, yeah.
To have a decision like that is dramatic and interesting in a narrative, but is it interesting in a game?
In a game, yes. Yeah. And it's that constant tension, I suppose, between the fact that people want narrative and want plot and want character, and certainly modern role-playing games are all pushing in that direction, but you still can't escape the fact that there's a game element to it.
Yeah.
You know, there is a game element to what you're doing.
Yeah. So the way that you make it interesting is that, you know, you're given the instruction to kill him.
Mm. Yeah.
And you follow that instruction, and then word comes through, actually, it is a mistake. The intelligence is wrong.
Yeah.
It's the wrong person we've identified.
Yeah.
If you've already made that decision to do it, then there are consequences.
There are consequences, yeah. Yeah, you can do it that way. But that's not the same as... I mean, that's not what that episode does. What the episode does is it doesn't really do that. It assumes that it's guaranteed, it's concrete, that he's going to do this. The plot is driven by the moral problem of doing what you have to do.
Yeah.
And that's the thing with a role-playing game. It's a bit difficult to do that, isn't it?
Yeah. I do recommend to people Spooks, because it does have preposterous RPG situations.
It does, yeah. It's good from that point of view. If you were going to run a espionage come action RPG, you could do a lot worse than watch episode of Spooks.
And steal from it.
And steal ideas from it, yeah. Yeah, it does do that. I mean, that's one of the interesting things. It's like, I think it's Matthew McFadden's character has a relationship with a woman, doesn't he, that he can't tell her what he does.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of ridiculous plot lines about keeping that secret. And I think that'd be interesting in an RPG, you know, that you've got to keep what you're doing secret from somebody, an NPC, but the constant threat they're going to find out. So it's good from that point of view. Yeah. It's you could lift quite a lot from it, I think.
So that's two more for our big, overcomplicated audience participation. Yes. Thing. So well done for that. Well, I'm going to hand over to Big Jack Brass, who's going to look at rules, and I've lent him your wig, if that's all right.
Oh, what? Can I take legal action? Oh, am I in fear of redundancy? Are we getting a P45?
Yeah, I didn't want to break it to you. Until next time. See you later.
Goodbye.
Big Jack Brass rules. For this section, John has donned Judge Blythe's wig on a timeshare. He's fingering Blythe's gavel to look under the bonnet at the rules and mechanics that make mercenary spies and private eyes work. Hello, John. So you've got your wig on there, is it?
It's tight? A bit. I've actually got a very large hat size, not big head, large hat size. So it's a bit tight. And although Blythe isn't here, I think he would appreciate me saying stop saying fingering.
I will. I'll promise I will. Promise I will. So we're going to look at the rules. And it's fair to say that it's built on the chassis of the Tunnels and Trolls rules, isn't it?
It's built on the chassis, pretty much the engine, the wheels, and everything. It's got slightly different bodywork. Yeah. And a few extras, but it's fifth edition is the version of Tunnels and Trolls that this most resembles, for the very simple reason that that's how it started out. They played it. There's a mention in the rule book itself. There's a section which gets renamed in the Sleuth reprint, and the first line in it basically is the first testing of the MSP firearm system that ever took place was a game session referred to jokingly as Tunnels and Thompsons because it took place inside a dungeon. So it was a 5th to 10th level dungeon, and a load of guys with automatic weapons go in and give it a run. Well, you know, a lot of people have done that sort of thing. I've done that. But that's how it started. It's quite clearly Tunnels and Trolls. And why start a game from the ground up if you've got a system that fundamentally works?
So we're going to look at three rules that you particularly like and one that you want to ditch. So first of all, let's have a look at the ones that you like. Let's pick the first one.
Well, first thing is it's going to be the skill system, really. It's the most obvious change from Tunnels and Trolls. There are minor tweaks in combat and that kind of stuff. The length of the combat round changes because, as he says, you're not posturing, so it's only 30 seconds, not 2 minutes like Tunnels and Trolls. But the big difference and the big section is really skills. Now, Mike Stackpole wrote an article for Sorcerer's Apprentice for skills in Tunnels and Trolls. That got reprinted at the end of one of the later reprints of TNT. And this is essentially the same thing. You have lists of skills at different IQ levels, and you make saving rolls against them, really. You have so many points to sort of get your levels.
So just remind us how the saving roll works.
The saving roll system for sort of Tunnels and Trolls and Mercenaries is essentially you're rolling 2 6-sided dice. Mm-hmm. You've got your attribute or your skill level or whatever. And it's a formula that is the level of the saving roll times 5 plus 15 minus your attribute, which sounds more complicated than it is. So essentially a first level saving roll, whatever number you've got in your ability, you take that off 20 and try to get equal to or better than the result on 2d6. Doubles, add and roll over. So it has an exploding dice system. They can just keep going if you keep rolling doubles. So if, for example, you're trying to think of that clue that you saw, you know, put the things together, and you just roll against your straight IQ, if you've got an IQ of 8, well, you've got to get 12 or more on 2d6, so hope for doubles.
But what I liked about revisiting the rules is how broadly defined the skills are. So you can see how, on the fly, you could apply these to lots of situations.
Yeah. Well, don't forget, the name of the game tells you that it's actually covering a pretty wide area. Because it's mercenaries, spies, private eyes. They're not actually entirely compatible in some ways. If you're doing a mercenary mission, as anyone who's played Traveller knows, it doesn't really fit in with a kind of freewheeling, let's make a few quid on the side mission. And if you've got a carefully constructed mystery and you send in a load of guys with guns, well, it doesn't necessarily fit. So to come up with a skill system and a list of skills that, that fit everything without it seeming too much like the kitchen sink, I think was quite a feat. The character sheet at the end, which is different in your version, actually has a note on it saying that they forgot. here it's at the end of the index. It says, three skills so common as to be taken for granted by the author are driving, cooking and swim. So effectively everyone can drive, cook and swim.
Yeah.
So those skills are kind of missing. Right. But I think they just somebody just went, well, hang on, what about driving? It's like, yeah, of course, everybody can drive. You know, this is America. And if you want to play Harry Palmer, cooking is pretty essential.
Yes. We picked up on that in Top Secret, that they had home economics as a skill.
Yeah. Yeah. If you ever watch Ipcress Farm and all that, the author, funnily enough, Len Dayton, I have a copy of his cookbook here.
Yeah.
The Action Cookbook.
Is there nothing that's not in your library? I mean, that's
quite a few things, actually. Yeah. There are a few notable things missing, but I'm working on them. There's a bit of an oddity in the skills, and it's easy to change, and it's probably easy to overlook. Because they're at levels of IQ, there are one or two that you look at and think, right, hang on, you're telling me that I have to be more intelligent to do skydiving than I do to do hang gliding.
Right.
So you can say to them, you're definitely intelligent enough to throw yourself out of a plane, but you're not. However, you can strap a wing to your back and jump off a cliff, that's fine.
Yeah.
And you just think, well, that's a bit odd. And there's one or two others, you know, mountaineering, you need an IQ of 8. And you start moving up the others, you can get doctorates, elocution, ambush and silent movement. I said, well, I don't know, do you really need an IQ of 10 for that compared to skydiving as like an IQ 8? You can easily put those in different levels if you're annoyed that he thinks you have to be a certain intelligence level to fight underwater, for instance. But again, I mean, that's minor stuff. The advancement system, the experience, is a little more complicated than in Tunnels and Trials because, of course, you are trying to up the skills that you've used, so you sort mm-hmm. of get 50 points a time and tally them. A lot of people just use a little 5-bar gate checkmark system when they're doing it instead. It works pretty well. And it also, as well as when you get to the end, you notice that it starts to get a bit more exotic. So as well as acting, you get martial arts, which is almost a separate combat system in its answer. And then you get onto things like granted and hereditary titles and psychic skills, because this also covers those kind of things like the Champions and all the sort of 60s super spy that like the Avengers. It was all went over into psychic abilities and a bit of weirdness. That's in there as well. If he'd put all of this in the title of the game, there wouldn't have been a cover illustration. Mercenary spies and private eyes and vampires and werewolves and psychics and martial artists.
I must admit, I missed that back in the day. I missed the that it had that ability to do that. I just saw this as a fairly straightforward modern
game. Well, because it's mostly marketed that way.
Yeah.
Every sort of advert for it was really focusing more on, in fact, the kind of the spy side. It was always shadowy figures, you know, with a gun and a trench coat and people breaking into a safe and all that. I don't know if that was to try and differentiate itself from other things on the market, or because that really is its main focus. It's not mostly a game about psychic mercenaries. Now I've said that out loud, that sounds really cool, doesn't it?
We'll make a note of that one.
Yeah. Right. Psychic mercenaries. Also. Yeah, martial artists, psychic mercenaries. So I don't know. You've got to focus a game in some way, otherwise it becomes a generic system and everybody says, oh, it's too much work to run a game with that.
Yeah. But I think it does strike that balance. I think you're right to point out the skills do that. They kind of give you enough to play with. And as I say, you know, you look at those and you think, on the fly, I could deal with more situations with these skills.
You've got to accept that this game came out in 1983, and although there was another printing in 86 with some changes, it wasn't a second edition, really.
Yeah.
So the skills and equipment, they do have some things now that are obviously a bit dated. You know, it's 34, 35 years old. So the computing skill and all that kind of stuff you might think is a bit simplistic, but it's dead easy to just
To change.
Just agree with everybody what it covers from a modern perspective.
Okay, so what's next up? What's your next role?
Where have we gone? So that was skills. The Megadeth lock saving roll is really important in a game where it's very easy to die. This game is very lethal, which is quite funny in that Tunnels and Trolls, although it has a reputation for killing everybody off, that's only because things just get to such a ridiculous level. You can actually take quite a pounding in Tunnels and Trolls.
Yeah.
You can't in this, and you'll discover why as soon as you pull a gun or think, yeah, go on, I can take a couple of shots and pick him off. No, you can't. Your attributes don't go up the same way that they do in Tunnels and Trolls.
No.
You know, when you
no.
get a wizard with 50 strength, that doesn't happen in this game. It's trying to be on a much more realistic level.
And of course, you don't have racial differences as well, so you can't adapt your base attributes in the same way.
No, it's exactly right. And because Tunnels and Trolls doesn't have hit points so much, it's based on your constitution, you're not dealing with something like a kind of hit point soak before you really take any damage.
Mm.
It doesn't have action points or tokens that say, yep, okay, here's what actually happened, you know, anything that lets you rewrite that sudden death. So the Megadeth luck saving roll, it's an optional roll, it's actually quite vague, doesn't tell you what level it is. It's up to the GM to say, yeah, go on, make a level one, you know, you shouldn't have been in that situation, it's my fault. And the GM can just say, sure, let's go. The other thing I like about it, because it puts something like that in a relatively open discussion sort of rule, it says, well, hey, here's something we jokingly call the Megadeth luck saving roll. I think it hints to the GM that you can do more than just slavishly follow the rules.
Yes.
It's telling you you've got to come up with the level for the rule. So really, should you be using it at all? Is this a situation where it's not going to be much fun if everybody dies?
Yes.
You know, it's only 7:30, we're supposed to be playing till 10. Yeah, go on, get away with that, but they've tied you up, you're captured, you know, in a warehouse. What are you going to do now?
And I think the lethal nature of it, I get the sense from reading the rules that they're trying to encourage players to do things that are different than just open confrontation. They're trying to encourage you to use your skills and use your abilities to overcome a situation rather than just firing in.
Well, you've got to look at the sources for this game. And another very good thing about it is Mike Stackpole's quite explicit about his influences and sources. The game is dedicated to Jacques Futrelle, who's an author who's pretty much forgotten now. Although you can actually get all of his most famous stories for like a quid on Kindle. He came with a character called the Thinking Machine, who was very much in the sort of Sherlock Holmes mould, and was just a really awful person, an incredibly unlikable character, who was an utterly brilliant sort of deductive detective. And he did like the ultimate locked room mystery where he says, yeah, you can lock me in the high security prison, I'll be out in 2 days. Yeah. And then he gets out and he sort of, how did you do that? So that's not about gunplay. None of those stories are really about gunplay. Jacques Futrelle, actually, he's possibly more remembered because he went on a cruise in 1912 on a ship that's become known as being quite unsinkable, but unfortunately... So yeah, he was lost on the Titanic, which is a bit sad. He was very much an up-and-coming author. So you've got things like that. You've got Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. Here's a copy that belonged to my dad in the 60s. This is all Agatha Christie and people like that. And Ellery Queen, of course. A lot of mysteries. When guns come out, they're never the first choice of solving a problem.
Mm.
Go on to things like the Humphrey Bogart movies and the sort of noir thrillers and that. Guns come out, there's gunplay. There's very, very rarely any extended exchange of gunplay. And if it is, it's people leaning around a corner, shooting, and then desperately jumping back as somebody shoots. Missing more than hitting. All of these things, even the kind of Mission Impossible and the 60s and 70s, things like that, they're not really about massive exchanges of gunfire until you get onto the mercenary side. And you're looking at Dogs of War and all those, Dirty Dozen, you know.
Mm.
Virtually everyone dies.
Yes, yeah.
It's relatively faithful, not just to real life, but actually to its source material.
Yeah.
And I think it does encourage you to think twice, particularly if you're on your second or third game and you're thinking, that last one was kind of short, wasn't it? Perhaps if we don't run out into a hail of bullets this time. Yeah. Because it will just go all Butch and Sundance on you, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Okay, what's the third thing you've got there, John?
What is the third thing I've got here? It's not really the rules. It's, in many ways, for a lot of people, I think it's the most valuable thing in this game. You may never run this system, but the sections for the Games Master are terrific. They were pretty much game-changing at the time when it came out. How to run mercenary missions, spy scenarios, how to put together, you know, the one called the Art of Detection, how to put together a real mystery for people to solve, the pitfalls of it, the sort of things people expect. It's got all that kind of stuff, things about motives, misdirection. It's you know, page after page of really interesting stuff. I think it's notable that the mercenary missions is barely 2 pages long, whereas the Art of Detection is, you know, half a dozen. It's a terrific resource, and a lot of that has influenced other games that you can get now, and you'll see its sort of legacy in systems today that are about detection. But it was groundbreaking, and most of the information in there still makes an awful lot of sense. It's really worth reading. Considering it's such a cheap game, I think it's almost worth buying just for those bits.
I think we pointed out in our podcast about Top Secret that to produce a really good narrative around our adventure around espionage is very difficult. And I think that the advice in it is really good, because I think Top Secret's approach was very much to try and codify it, to turn it into a flow chart of possibilities. But here it's more of a commentary, isn't it? More of a giving hints and tips. And
It's very much the sort of advice you get from a writer,
yes,
rather than a gamer in some ways. But it's not isolated from a game. It actually applies to a game. If you just read an article on how to write a mystery novel, it's not necessarily adaptable to a game. And Mike Stackpole, somebody who he's a novelist, he's an author, and a games designer, and he's good at both. So that, I think, is what makes it such a rare commodity. You can find lots of backgrounds about mysteries and spy stories, and you can watch lots of source material. He's distilled it down into the useful, applicable stuff.
And I like this, how it encourages the Games Master to come up with a super weapon and then spend, you know, some time, sit down and work out different ways in which that can be used and applied, and it can be misused, and the damage it could cause, and then have a think about how you would stop somebody using it who didn't, you know, who didn't want to use it. And making it fail safe. So it really does try and encourage you to be creative around some.
Of course, as a games master, you know that the key with a super weapon is never let the PCs actually get the damn thing, because that's the rest of your campaign completely scuppered.
Yeah. Give the device a good chance of failing or exploding when working.
He's well ahead of me. It's not a mechanical section of the rulebook at all. It's very readable, it's well written, and it's just terrific advice. And don't forget, for a lot of people, particularly when this came out, with no internet and that kind of stuff, with no back and forth communication outside of your own game group, really, that sort of advice was quite hard to come by.
Yeah.
Most of the stuff in magazines was for fantasy games.
Yeah.
And a fantasy game, yes, you can run mercenary missions and you can run spies and you can run, but it isn't the same, because you've almost certainly got magic and you've almost certainly got people who can walk into a hail of crossbow bolts and get through it unscathed. Totally changes the balance.
Yes.
That said, of course, this game does let you do that as well, because it's got another section on working with tunnels and trolls and mercenary spies and private eyes. So if you want to do all that stuff, go ahead.
I agree, and I think if you only need one reason to get hold of a copy of this, I think getting hold of that advice is it's well worth it.
Actually, I think it's a game that if you could get it easily, a lot of games shops will be able to order this in, but some will give you a blank look, but you can get it mail order. But if we could get an easy PDF, it would have a modest surge of popularity, I think, because people would be able to look at it and see again what it's got to offer.
Yes.
but you know, nobody knows it's around.
Okay, what is the one thing that you would ditch? What's the one thing that doesn't work?
I don't know if I'd go as far as saying something I'd ditch. I can point out something mechanically that doesn't work, but it's not in the original version of the game. It's actually in the reprint that you've got, Sleuth. There's a section in the original game called Tunnels and Thompsons, and it's about using supernatural and fantasy elements in the game. Basically, if you want a magic system, you get Tunnels and Trolls, and you're on that. Now, when Sleuth did their reprint, they called it Night Stalkers, which, let's be honest, it's not as fun a name for it, is it? and I now can't find it. Page 45, I think. And they expanded it a little bit, added a few things in, and one of the brilliant things they did was include the rules for dinosaurs. So you can do Lost World mysteries and things like that. Now, this is all great, but if you look in the section Bad Guys and Beasties, it's got some of the animals you could come up against. One of them is a German Shepherd. It's very likely you come up against a German Shepherd in a sort of spy scenario. Yeah, yeah, you're going to have some security guard or some Nazi patrolling, and they'll have that. Oh, that's actually worth saying, that the game isn't actually set in any particular era. It's it's very much, you know, 1890s to modern day. The Sleuth edition, I have no idea why, but every single dinosaur, if you look at their stats in isolation, they look great, but the T-Rex has the same stats as a German Shepherd. And I can't work out where they've gone so horribly wrong on this, but all of the dinosaurs are effectively small dogs. So ditch those. Don't just think, oh yeah, I'll throw a dinosaur into this, it'll be brilliant, and just write down the stats from the book, because your players are about to laugh at you.
Although it would make a good sequel to Jurassic Park.
Can you just picture it? You just hear this earth shaking roar, and this thing's like, comes out, and it's the size of a poodle.
That's great. I think I'm going to have an honourable mention as well for the range and targets. I noticed that one of the examples that it gives of a target is a child.
I've forgotten that. Well, yeah, and people ask me why I like this game so much. You know. Well, they're tough targets. They're small. They dodge a lot. People frown on you shooting. There are all sorts of reasons why it's not. Yeah, that's perhaps not a great example. The classic one, I've printed this out from Space Gamer issue 72 from 1985. One of their Murphy's Rules. Somebody pointed out that if you take a family car in Mercenary Spy and Private Eyes, rev it up to 100 miles an hour and ram a tank, it'll demolish the tank and you've got a 50-50 chance you can still drive the car afterwards.
That's brilliant.
That's a classic example of what Steve Jackson called playtest the dumb scenarios. if you're up against sensible people as players, they will never try to ram a tank with a car because nothing would happen to the tank.
Yeah.
Somebody has a go, and what do you know? The rules are a little bit off there.
That's great. Well, thank you very much for inviting me back to Watson Hall.
Delightful.
And
to see you.
Going through your library. Thank you very much, John.
Hi, I'm DM Mike.
And I'm DM Liz.
We're from the Save for Half podcast.
And you're listening to the Grognard Files.
Where Judge Blivey is wrong.
No, he's not.
There isn't another bit. Thank you to John Hancock, Big Jack Brass, for his hospitality at Watson Hall. He's on the radio so much that he's starting to develop knobs and dials. If you want to listen to Watson Hall's actual play collection, they're available at UK Roleplays Forum. And he'll also be appearing on a new podcast that I've been enjoying recently, Desert Island Dungeons. It's an interview show where guests select RPGs that they'd want to save from a sinking ship to play with a group of enthusiastic monkeys on a desert island. I've not a clue what John will be selecting, but I do hope that the monkeys have got lots of D6s. Don't you? Now, Make sure you check out his Twitter feed too. It's always entertaining, and you'll find those hashtags that he mentioned, as well as the overlooked RPGs. Thanks a lot, John. Now, let's talk about fanzines. Regular listeners will know that last year we produced the Grognard File zine, thanks to the contribution of patrons. That zine is now generally available on DryThruRPG for download, along with the collected Daily Dwarf, a compendium of contributions from @DailyDwarf. We enjoyed doing it so much last year that we're going to do it again this year. And we've already had some great contributions, including an article from none other than the troll father himself, Ken Santandre. If you'd like a copy of the new fanzine, then you'll need to be a patron before the end of August 2017. The zine will be launched at Grogmeet on the 11th of November 2017, and every patron will get a hard copy posted to them wherever they live in the world. The podcast will always be free, but the Patreon campaign allows us to do additional projects such as the fanzine. And we're also about to improve the hosting arrangements and site design of the grognardfiles.com. And we've invested in some new portable recording equipment. The Patreon campaign is, it makes you an honorary member of the Armchair Adventurers Club, a community, the Grog Squad. And we also have occasional online games. We've got the second session of Top Secret lined up, and RuneQuest and Gangbusters before the end of this year. Thank you to all of our patrons for their generous contributions. And we've had lots of new members, so welcome to you all. And these are at the $1 level, thanks to Mike Stable, Walter Morrison, Todd Mordin, R. Bud Wright, Jack Ackerman. Thanks go to Shannon Ferguson, who's increased his pledge to $2 a month. Shannon is the captain of the Canadian office of the Grog Squad, thanks to his enthusiasm for the podcast on Google Plus and other places. Thanks, Shannon. At $3.50, these patrons will get the second volume of the collected at Daily Dwarf. They're much better to read than to listen to my stupid voice, so it's well worth collecting. Thanks to Julian Haley, Mark Lamming, the brilliant artist who did the cover for the first Daily Dwarf collection, and The Smart Party, who backed up their review with support. Thanks, guys. At the $5 level support, well, I give these patrons an extra novelty insert to the zine if we reach certain targets, and I'd like to reward their commitment with a roll on a table from the game under discussion. Now, Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes is notable for its absence of tables, so I've reached for The Armoury, Volume 1. John kindly donated a copy to the Great Library of RPGs, so here goes. Okay, so thanks to Phil Cooper. I'm going to take something from the submachine gun list, and you've got 22 MP5K. I'm not providing bullets for health and safety reasons, so thanks, Phil. Thanks for that. Roger Cole, and he's contributed a fabulously icky Cthulhu scenario for the zine. So let's go for a grenade. Okay. 4. A 40mm MA33 HEDP. And that should sort out any shoggoths. Thanks, Roger. Thanks for that. Okay. Goody Watkins. 64. That's a gyrojet carbine. I have no idea what it is, but it sounds great. So thanks, Goody. Next up is Mike Mason, the line editor of Call of Cthulhu for KSEM, and he'll be appearing on the podcast soon. And he's boosted his pledge, so I'm going to go for a flamethrower table. Oh, one. That's a Flemmenwerfer Mitt Strafflothroton, I think. That sounds like a sausage in a beer, which might be preferable to a flamethrower. Thanks, Mike. Last but certainly not least is Callum from the excellent Released podcast, and he's boosted his pledge, and he can have 25 a mamba, which sounds like it could provide endless fun. Thanks, Callum. The next episode is all about fanzines from back in the day. Dagon, Runestones, Tempestuous Orifice, which was your favourite? We have a very special guest, Ian Marsh, editor of fanzine Dragon Lords, who went on to edit White Dwarf. Please write in with your favourites to be included in a special listener postbag section. After all, the best bits of fanzines was the letters page, wasn't it? And I like to see this podcast as a kind of oral fanzine. I suggested as much to John.
I've got an attitude, it's a bit like a fanzine, you know that.
Yeah.
It's the content, isn't it, that you're after? It's not...
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Spoken like a man who can't be asked editing, much like myself.
Adios, amigos.